Welcome to the Adult Bible Study. We're going to jump in here in a moment. We have our very last lesson on the book of Zechariah. My intent is to move into 1 Peter next week, spend some time in the New Testament, do 1 and 2 Peter. They're both relatively short. And then we'll maybe come back to the Old Testament and tackle Isaiah or something. We'll see what happens. But Zechariah 14, this is the chapter that pulls all of it together. I want to start reading something, though, from Matthew 23 and a couple of other New Testament passages that I'll kind of refer to later in the lesson, but just to tie it in, to help you see a bigger picture here. Zechariah is either the most or the second most messianic Old Testament book. It's also, you know, gets very little attention a lot of times, and I'm trying to show you, and I think you'll see it today. It really pulls together a lot of things about the future. In the book of Matthew, it is not organized chronologically. It's organized thematically with two prominent discourses or sermons. The Sermon on the Mount and the one we call the Olivet Discourse. The Sermon on the Mount is chapters 5 to 7. And the Olivet Discourse is Matthew 24 and 25. And they are bookends for his teaching ministry. Everything is really just about contained in there. If you compare them side by side, they have a lot of similarities. I'll just say that. What happens in the course of Matthew is that he's really trying to answer a couple of questions. One is about why so many Jewish people, including the leadership, rejected Christ. Why were the Pharisees at war with Jesus? And the other question is about when the kingdom is going to come. Jesus never told them, hey, there's not really going to be a kingdom like you expected it. He said it's going to be exactly what you expected, but not now. And so these are two issues he's dealing with. And in dealing with this idea of, well, what happened? You know, why did so many Jewish people, reject him? It really spends a lot of time on the leadership and the Pharisees. And it comes to a head in Matthew 12, where Jesus cast out a demon. And they say that he's done it by the power of Beelzebub, and that becomes a turning point where he begins to pour out judgment on that generation. And it begins with him telling them, I'm going to start teaching in parables specifically so that you won't understand what I'm saying. Yes, ma'am. No, it's a good question. Did they reject Jesus because of the teaching of the Pharisees? I think largely yes. They were extremely influential. The Sadducees had the money, but they weren't influential from the standpoint of the theology.
Yeah, they were liberal.
They were, and the Sadducees didn't consider most of what we would call the scripture. They didn't believe in angels, didn't believe in resurrection. The Pharisees were highly influential. And there simply wasn't an expectation that Messiah would die, even though it's in the scriptures. And so there's this turning point. And when they accuse him of doing this by the power of Beelzebub, he begins teaching in parables. And chapter 13 is full of parables about how the kingdom will be delayed. I mean, they seem like hard parables on the surface, but the core message is it's going to be delayed for a time. And this comes to a head in Matthew 23 and 24, where he raises this issue again of a judgment on that generation and the delay of the kingdom. So Matthew 23, which is very long, the one thing I would say to you, read that chapter sometime and just highlight every time he says, woe to you. This is not a seeker-friendly sermon in Matthew 23. The God of the universe is talking to a group of people, and his words to them are, woe to you, a funeral dirge. They're not even dead yet, but they're going to be. And it's just a very dark passage in that sense. And it culminates, verse 29 of chapter 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And he talks about more about their bad doctrine. They've misled so many people. They're called snakes, brood of vipers, verse 33. He says he sent prophets to them. Some of them you'll kill and crucify. I mean, they're rejecting everything. So in verse 37, he says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. That is the assessment. What was the last prophet that they killed?
It wasn't John the Baptist.
Yeah, John the Baptist. I mean, he's the very forerunner of Messiah, prophesied, you know, and there'll be a forerunner again in the book of Revelation. I get that. But I mean, they kill, you know, him. And he says of this city of Jerusalem, and the book of Zechariah has a focal point on Jerusalem, especially in what we'll see in chapter 14. So there's a reason I'm here. He says, Jerusalem who kills the prophets, how often I wanted to gather your children together. You know, throughout the Zechariah, throughout the prophets, there's a talk about a regathering. Because by the time of the first century, the Jewish people are living all around. When we look at 1 Peter, you know, starting next week, we're going to get into 1 Peter. He claims to write from Babylon. That's what he says. We'll have to struggle with what that means. It's almost certainly not Rome. But people will say, well, there weren't, only Gentiles say this. Gentiles in their commentaries say he couldn't write from Babylon because there were no Jewish people. If you read any Jewish sources, there were Jewish people in Babylon in the first century, in and around it. I mean, they were everywhere. They were just scattered everywhere. So this idea of regathering them was a common theme of the Old Testament. God scattered them, according to Zechariah. We saw it earlier in the book. God sowed their seed everywhere, but in the future he'll bring them together. He wanted to do that. And the truth is, he would have done it in the first century. In this moment when he was speaking, he could have done that. But they would have said no. They didn't want to come. So your house is left desolate. That's the whole country. It's left desolate. What's fixing to happen? In a few decades, the city's going to fall. Jerusalem is going to fall. Until, he says, you will not see me again. The implication is you will, but you're going to see me again when a certain event happens. What is it? Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. They weren't saying that in the first century. Now, they were very happy at the triumphal entry, but it didn't take long before they were saying, give us Barabbas instead of this Jesus. This pictures the spiritual revival that the last two lessons in Zechariah, chapters 12 and 13, they're all about a coming spiritual revival. That revival is what's going to, among the Jewish people, is what's going to precede his second coming and some other events, and we're going to tie a bunch of them up today in chapter 14. But just understand, there has to be this spiritual revival, but there's more. He goes from there. He leaves the temple, starting in chapter 24. I'm just kind of describing what's there, and we'll look at a couple of verses. And when he leaves the temple, it says in verse 3, while he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, this is another prophetic focal point. Okay, and we're gonna see the Mount of Olives prominent in Zechariah 14. He picked this place on purpose. He picked the place to preach about his second coming that will be the locale of his second coming. That's the point. He's picked this with great intention. And when you're on the Mount of Olives, you're looking down Kidron Valley, and then the mount on the other side has the temple on it. So they're looking at the temple that he said in verse 2, do you see all these things? And they're looking at it. Yeah, we see it. Not one stone will be left on another. Okay, it's going to be destroyed. So they take him privately, as they were often would do, especially in Matthew, like back in chapter 13 when he was teaching in parables and they started glazing over, and they took him private and they said, what are you talking in parables for? They take him privately and say, well, when's all this going to happen? So it's while he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, they approached him privately and said, tell us, when will these things happen and what is the sign of your coming in the end of the age? They wanted it to be on a calendar, and he doesn't give them that. Instead, he gives them signs. And it becomes very obvious, and we don't have time to go through this whole passage here, but it comes very obvious that when he speaks to them, he is speaking beyond their time. He says things will happen to them that never happened. We know for a fact they never happened. And therefore, it was never about just them. And that's the pattern throughout Old Testament prophecy. Most of the stuff we read in Zechariah and what we'll cover today, nobody saw it fulfilled that actually heard that message. He said, you, and nothing happened to them because it was so far out. Sometimes prophecies are near term, but not always. And so he begins talking to them, and what he does makes a lot of sense. He says, watch for the signs. There's going to be some signs. And for a while early in chapter 24, it's like the whole book of Revelation got collapsed into a single chapter. He talks about some things in a general sense, and he gets more specific. But just understand, he's giving signs. And I'm just going to jump in verse 29 of chapter 24. He says, after the distress, immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not shed its light. This is a common thing that we see in prophecy stuff. I think it came up in Zechariah. It's definitely there in Joel chapter 2 that gets quoted in Acts chapter 2 by Peter when he's preaching. It's in other places. The idea that there'll be cosmic signs in the heavens, things where it goes dark, whether that's the result of warfare and things, I don't know. But it will happen. And then he says, then, verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the people of the earth will mourn. Why? Well, one thing's evident, they're going to see it. They're going to see the sign of the Son of Man. If you read 30 books on Matthew, you'd probably get 30 answers about what the Son of Man is. So I will give you answer 31 when we go to Zechariah 14. But just know, people will say, what's the Son of Man's sign? What's it going to be? But just you see it here. And people will mourn and they will see. Okay, this he's not going to return. Earlier in the chapter, he warns them. People are going to say, oh, the Christ is out here in the desert. And he's out here hiding in Chapel Hill. And he said, when you hear that, they're lying. Because when I return, everybody's going to know. It's a very public thing. And he says, they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. On the clouds of heaven. Interesting. We're going to see that again. I want you to just kind of connect the dots. With power and great glory. And then he begins these parables that we can't go through. But if I could summarize all the parables except the analogy about the sheep and goats that comes at the end, the message is be ready. Every one of these messages in one way or another is be ready, because they weren't ready the first time. And be ready for my return is to be ready in faith. They weren't ready in faith before. That's the whole reason they rejected him. And so the warning is to be ready. But jump over to Acts, Acts 1. We'll just see one more thing that'll help us tie together some pieces here in Zechariah. Acts 1, Luke writes Acts in his gospel. It's like a sequel to his gospel. Jesus is already resurrected. They're waiting for the Holy Spirit to come. Jesus had promised that would happen. And you see that here in Acts 1:4. But they ask him in Acts 1:6, the same question they asked him in Matthew 24. I mean, it's stated slightly differently, but the fundamental question is, when are you coming back? When are you going to implement the kingdom? All right, they asked him, Lord, are you restoring the kingdom to Israel at this time? No. So the question is, when? He said to them, it's not for you to know the times. We would like to have a date and it'd be convenient. We have signs. And I think, yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry, but even Christ said in Matthew that he didn't know the times.
That's right. Jesus in his incarnation said only the Father knows the time. And so it's, why people, shouldn't be predicting dates and all that kind of nonsense. He chose to give signs because people of faith are supposed to be watching. And when he returns, it is precisely because Israel will have experienced a national revival that they will be looking at these scriptures. They'll be looking at Matthew 24. They will be looking at the signs, and they will be ready. People who aren't of faith will have no reason to look at Matthew 24. They reject it anyway. They won't be ready. He says it's not for you to know, but you're going to receive the power of the Holy Spirit, so they're going to wait for that. And then he ascends. Verse 9, he was taken up while they were watching, and a cloud took him out of their sight. And while he was going, they're gazing up into heaven, meaning up into the clouds. Suddenly two men in white clothes stood by them, presumably angels. They said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking up into heaven? The same Jesus who has been taken from you into heaven will come in the same way that you've seen him going into heaven. Right? They physically saw him ascend. There's going to be a time when they physically see him return that way. And then verse 12 tells us this all happened on the Mount of Olives. So I just wanted you to see that and have that in mind. Let me see here.
Because he'll return on the Mount of Olives as well, correct?
That was going to be, yes. That's what I think is going to be indicated. One last passage is Revelation 19. And I'm touching these things because they're all somehow connected to Matthew or to Zechariah 14. Long chapter in Revelation 19, the Apostle John, who gave us the fourth gospel, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and this book, Revelation, it is the revelation, the apocalypsis of Jesus. It's one revelation, not many. The whole book is about Jesus being unveiled to the world. And the moment of his return is captured here in chapter 19, verse 11. Then I saw heaven opened, and there was a white horse. The rider is called Faithful and True. This is speaking of Christ, and the idea of him being true is used a lot in John's writings. He said in John 14, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Not a truth and not a proposition about the way things are. He is the exact expression of reality. The character and works of God, the redemptive works of God, the truth in its totality and comprehensive nature. So he's called Faithful and True, and with justice he judges and makes war. He would say, all judgment's been given into my hand. And these are things that it's pulling together from what's happened. But look how he judges. He had a name written on him that no one knows except himself. It's an indication that he is above in authority everybody without exception. To know his name or to name him would be a show of authority in his time. No, his name is one no one knows because he's going to be the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He wore a robe dipped in blood. His name is called the Logos of God, which is the word that John used in opening his gospel. In the beginning was the Logos. The armies that were in heaven followed him on white horses, wearing pure white linen. I think these probably include angels and regenerate people, resurrected people. A sharp sword came from his mouth. Now, I suspect Jesus doesn't actually, you know, I can remember being a kid, and this just surprised me. You know, you watch people on TV and they swallowed a sword. You ever seen that, sword swallowers? It's a highly risky business to be in. I don't think Jesus is a sword swallower. But the sword is a sign of execution, of death. And it comes from his mouth. He doesn't... Yes, he speaks and they die. He doesn't have to you know, pull out his lightsaber and go at them, as cool as that would be. And he certainly can do that. But I think the sword that comes out of his mouth will get explained in Zechariah 14. That's why I'm reading the passage. And he called Lazarus to life. He can call other people to death. That's all it takes. And so he will... rule them with an iron rod. He'll trample the winepress of the fierce anger of God, the Almighty. He has a name written on his robe and on his thigh, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So with that in mind, I know that's a lot of background, but we'll tie these things together pretty quickly. Zechariah 14. Now, Zechariah 12, 13, and 14 are a unit. The chapter breaks should not be there from the standpoint of it being one seamless unit of thought. Chapter 13 ended with a couple of verses about a future spiritual revival. Chapter 13, 8 and 9, in the whole land, this is the Lord's declaration, two-thirds will be cut off and die. The land is Israel, the Jewish people. Two-thirds will be cut off and die, and a third will be left in it. I will put the third through the fire. This is a refiner's fire. He's not destroying them or putting them through judgment. He's going to put the third, the one-third of the people, the remnant, through the fire. I will refine them as silver is refined. I'm going to remove the dross, the impurities, in other words, the sin. I will test them as gold is tested. That's an interesting statement. When you read the first chapter of 1 Peter, you're going to see it there. This is like things that he has in mind. He's not just like coming up with these things. The gold is tested. They will call on my name. What do you say in Matthew 23? You're not going to see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. This is what he's talking about. Like, these are coming together. It's a revival where they are going to call on his name. And he will answer them, they are my people, the Lord is our God. Early in the book, he said that the people of God, Israel, is the pupil, or in the old translation, the apple of God's eye, which suggests you shouldn't really try to mess with them. People are going to mess with them in the next verse. And then they're going to call on their Father in faith, okay, based on now they've believed in Christ as the Messiah. And he's going to say, these are my people, and I'm going to take care of them. I'm just kind of paraphrasing, in a sense, what's going to happen. So the question becomes, how does he refine them through the fire, and when? So when we get to chapter 14, he's still talking about the same thing. Two-thirds go and they die. One-third is refined through the fire. Here's the fire. Look, a day belonging to the Lord is coming. Now, I pointed out before that we have 20 references to that day in this book, but we actually only have one reference to the, quote, day of the Lord. It's throughout the writing prophets, but it only gets used one time here in Zechariah. He says a day is coming, a day belonging to the Lord is coming, when the plunder taken from you, none of the people that heard this message around 520 BC had anything taken from them. But when people get to Matthew, they say, whoa, he's talking to the disciples, and so it all had to happen to them. That's not how prophetic literature works, and we don't get to change the rules when we get the New Testament. He can talk to you as Israel is representative of a coming generation, and in particular, a refined people. He says the plunder will be taken from you. You know what plunder is? That's coming in and stealing people's stuff, and divided in your presence. I will gather, God does the gathering, all the nations against Jerusalem for battle. In the New Testament Revelation, this is called the Battle of Armageddon. The word occurs some in the Old Testament, but so we can call it that. They think they're gathering to do battle with a world leader that has positioned himself in Jerusalem. Sometimes we call him the Antichrist. I don't know what his real name will be. But God says, this isn't really you. I'm pulling you in here, because I'm going to deal with you. And the point is, they're winning. I mean, when the battle starts, it looks like they're winning. They're actually going to take the plunder from Israel. And if that's happening, it sure doesn't look like the Jewish people are winning this thing. It's going to be divided in your presence. The city, and he's very specific about it being Jerusalem. Like I said, Jerusalem's the focal point. The city will be captured. That looks like a win. You see, it's the ultimate underdog story. Everybody likes an underdog story. That's why Rocky made so much money, right? It's an underdog story, but it goes way past the time when anybody thinks there's a chance they can pull this one out. It's like that thing he did with Abraham and Sarah. He waited till they've been on Social Security for like 50 years and then they have a baby, right? Because it had to wait to a time when everybody knew there's no explanation but God. And that's how this will be. No explanation but God. The city's captured. The houses are looted. House-to-house battle, and typical of what warfare does. They go and steal stuff. The women are raped. Half the city will go into exile. That doesn't mean they're taken away in bondage, I don't think. I think they ran. I think they left the city to, you know, as they knew this battle was coming. But the rest of the people will not be removed from the city. So about half the population stays behind. They're trapped. They're suffering. We just read what happens. They lose their stuff. They're being violated. All these terrible things. Then, verse 3, like at the last moment, when everybody says there's no way this is turning around, I suspect when a lot of people are saying, where's God in this? The question that's always asked. Then what happens? The Lord will go out to fight against those nations as he fights on the day of battle. Everything's turned around. Let's see how this actually unpacks, how it unfolds. But I'm suggesting to you that they are praying, this remnant, for deliverance. As they see the troops coming into the city, as they see them entering people's homes and taking their stuff, as they see the violence, they're praying, Lord, deliver us. Yes, ma'am?
I just have a question.
Yeah.
I've heard so much teaching on this. Do you think that this is before we are taken up, or do you think that this is after Christians are taken up? Will we see this?
Well, that
I know it's a big question.
Well, no, I mean, I don't have time to defend one position or the other, but certainly a lot of folks would say there's an event called the rapture, we probably should call it the resurrection, that happens before this period of time, that sometimes is called Daniel's 70th week or the tribulation. Others would say it's at the end. I'm not going to go down that whole trail, but if we're not taken up at the beginning, and then you got a real small minority that say sometime in the middle, but if not, then some of us will see it. What's to be sure is if you're alive then, you're going to know it's happening. I mean, it's going to capture the whole world's attention. And then, of course, in a moment when Jesus returns, every last person is going to know. Yeah. So it would depend on how you take it. It's not real important. What's clear is when the army comes with him, I read it from Zechariah 19 or Revelation 19. I think that will include not only angels, he's called the Lord of hosts throughout Zechariah, the Lord of armies, but also resurrected people. I think Christians are in that. So whenever we've left, beginning, middle, near the end, no one actually puts it right at the last minute. It's sort of right before the return. We're going to be there then. So hope it helps a little bit. So the Lord's going to go out and fight against those nations. And like I said, I think maybe in response to probably a lot of prayer. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. That's why I read Acts 1. Why are you sitting here staring at, they're still looking at the clouds because their jaws have fallen on the ground. Because the expectation was still that we get it now. He had to die first, but now he can implement the kingdom. And Jesus really said, no, still got to wait a while. And I think we'd all be standing there with our jaws on the ground if we saw him physically just float up into the clouds and disappear. And my amazement would get even worse when the two angels appear in front of me. What are you looking at? You've got a job to do, but you need to know he's going to come back in the same way. It's promising a literal physical return. And here he is on that day. What day? That day is short for the day of the Lord. That day, his feet stand on the Mount of Olives, which face Jerusalem on the east. And that's true, right? It faces Jerusalem. It looks down on the city. The Mount of Olives, now this is the part where people say, this can't really happen. God just can't do this. Not only can he do this, he kind of has to do this. One of the things about being God is you can create things from nothing. And part of his return, he's going to recreate and fix it. The Bible never tells us all the reasons why particular bad things are allowed to happen, why evil is allowed to prosper. We know why evil exists. We know about the fall. We want to know, why did this specific thing, why would God let that happen? What the Bible says is God's going to fix it. That's where the emphasis is. He's going to fix it. He's going to remove the evil. And when he comes to a land that's been laid waste by war, he's going to fix it. He's going to rescue the people. He's going to fix the land. He's going to take us back to Genesis chapter 1 before it all got broke. Look what happens. The Mount of Olives are split in half from the east to the west, forming a huge valley. I don't have time to go read it, but in chapter 3 of Joel looks to this same period of time. He talks about the events of this period of time, and he talks about these armies being pulled into the Valley of Jehoshaphat for judgment. The problem is there is no Valley of Jehoshaphat. It's a name. It just means it's not a proper noun. It's the Valley of God Judges. It's this valley, I think. He's creating a way of escape. But if you read Revelation 12, when the people try to escape, which was a big focus also of Matthew 24, he's got all these signs, and Jesus says, when you start seeing these signs, leave the city. Hope it's not the Sabbath, difficult to travel on the Sabbath in Jerusalem. Hope you're not pregnant or carrying a baby, but you should run. So where are they going to run? So they need a place of escape. But they're going to be pursued according to Revelation 12. These armies aren't just going to let people go. So we see this huge valley form so that the mountain will move to the north and to the south. Half to the north, half to the south. I don't know exactly how that happens. I'm thinking there's an earthquake of some sort that he's going to make happen. It's happened before. It happened the moment he was on the cross, gave up the ghost. It's happened before. He says, you'll flee by the mountain valley. It's exactly what he tells them to do in Matthew 24. He says, you need to run when you see these things happening. He's giving them. You understand the problem of running when you have to climb mountains? I'm great going down the mountains if it's a gentle decline. I like escalators, not stairs. You understand what I'm talking about? I got this great experience of going up the Great Wall of China, which is like super steep. It's all one level. The steps are really, really thin. And I don't make this up. There are people there in their 90s who go up every day. And I just remember this little old lady passing me up. I'm huffing and puffing, wishing I was down at the bottom with a Mountain Dew. And she just turned and looked, a little smile, and then went right on by me. Okay, so what do you do so people can make a clean getaway? You split the Red Sea and keep it dry. You split the Mount of Olives and you make a straight, level path. That's what he's doing. You'll flee by my mountain valley. These people he's talking to never did this. A future generation will. And he says, for the valley of mountains will extend to Azor. No idea where that's at, but I take it it's a long way, far enough away to get them to safety. You will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of King Uzziah. I'm not going to go into all that, but it's a real earthquake that had happened like more than a century earlier, and it's in their collective memory. The way a lot of events, if I said to all of y'all, you know, 9/11, you have like a collective memory of the event. So they remember, and they remember that they fled the city. This suggests to me there's going to be an earthquake that makes the valley. But they're going to flee. Then the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him. That was Revelation 19. See how it's pulling these things together. Revelation has new content, but a lot of it is pulling together Old Testament stuff and putting it all in one place for us. And Revelation said, he'll come on a white horse. That's the triumphal entry. When you read Zechariah 9, verse 9, first triumphal entry happened in the first century, riding on a donkey. But verse 10 of Zechariah 9, he's cracking heads together. That's what's happening here. That's the triumphal entry on the white horse in Revelation 19. And he's going to come, and all the holy ones with him. Then the Lord my God will come. Now, nobody's seen God at any time. He's a spirit. That's what John 1 says. Who are they going to see? How can they see the Lord my God come? It's Jesus. Okay? That's the point. And he's going to come on that day of verse 6, still this day of the Lord. That's not a 24-hour period. It's just a span of time. Now what he's going to do is it's not all in perfect order maybe, but he's going to fix the land. When you read the book of Genesis before the fall, there were rivers in the garden, God's garden. Man was authorized to tend it. But where do those rivers come from? Rivers we think about are water drainage from mountains and hills, and they make their way into a river. The Jordan River that we read about so much in the scripture, it comes from mountains in the north, down into the Sea of Galilee, which is just a lake, all the way down south to the Dead Sea. Then it stops because it's like the lowest sea level on the planet. And it's all salty, right? Why is it the Dead Sea and why is it there? I think because of this. But when you go back to Genesis, the rivers aren't off the mountains. The rivers are just sourced from God. Look at this. On that day, he says, lost the verse here. I skipped 6, I think. I'm going to read 8 and I'll back up a second. On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half of it toward the eastern sea and half toward the western sea, in summer and winter alike. Now, that could be the Mediterranean in the other direction. I think it's probably because of the way they thought about it, the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean. From the standpoint of their location, those were the east and the west. And these rivers are going to flow out. He calls them living waters. And they're going to flow out to these things. I wonder how they'll get there. Just look at the topography on a radar. It's, you know, I had a lawsuit years ago in an area that was really hilly like Chapel Hill. And the guy claimed that the cow pond at the front of the subdivision, the water was traveling like a mile away and bubbling up on his driveway, which I always found fascinating. But between the cow pond and his driveway, the hills went up and down. And I remember going to the courthouse and I just opened up a big topographical map to the judge. I'm like, see the hills? I just want to know how the water goes up and down. And he's like, threw the case out. It's a real problem. The water doesn't go up and down hills in Israel either, just like it doesn't do it here in Chapel Hill. It may go down the hills, but it doesn't usually go up them and the bubble out at the top, right? So what's Jesus doing? He's going to flatten the land. But it says, it's going to go both ways in summer and winter alike. Most rivers have their season when the water's high and when it's low. It's not going to be like that. It's an unquenchable source. And in a minute, he's going to talk about changing the land. Now, I skipped over verse 6. 6 is important. You know, I pointed out in Matthew 24, he talks about it being all dark, and then the sign of the Son of Man will come, but he doesn't tell us what it is. He just says, when you see it, you'll know it. The whole world will know it. I think it's this. I wouldn't fight over it, but it's my solution number 31 to what the sign of the Son of Man is. On that day, there will be no light. That's throughout Scripture. Joel says that. Revelation says that. The sky is darkened. You know, when you have war, and you can read history books about this, in the middle of the war, you can't see anything because all the fire and the smoke and the burning of the rubber and the plastic and people and all those things that are burned fill the sky, and you can't see a thing. It's not surprising to me, I think, that the sign of the Son of Man is that he's going to turn the light on in the middle of the night. Look what he says. The sunlight and moonlight will be diminished. It'll be a neat day known only to the Lord. Just like in the New Testament, when I'm going to tell you when all these things are going to happen on the exact day. Without day or night, but then look then. But there will be light at evening. You know, when you read the Genesis account, there's light before God says, let there be light, in the sense. Let me say this. There's light before God says, let there be stars, essentially, before he makes the stars and how the account goes. I think he's a light source. In Revelation, it talks about a lot of these things going away. There's not a sun anymore, but everything is lit up perfectly well. Why? Because Jesus is present and he's light. I think in the midst of the darkness, everything's going to lighten up all of a sudden. This is going to be the sign he's fixing to come. I read about the living waters. In verse 9, the Lord will become king. Where do we see that? Zechariah 9:9. That first triumphal entry passage, he was going to be king over the whole earth. Zechariah chapter 6, a crown was put on the high priest to make him a picture of a future coming king priest, Jesus. This book was always pointing to a future king, and here he is, and he's king over the whole earth, and so he's going to have to demonstrate that he is the king over the whole planet, not just the people, the dirt itself, the mountains, the rivers, king of all over it. That's why he can create new rivers. The Lord alone and his name alone, a reference to we call it the Shema in Deuteronomy chapter 6, but hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God. At this moment, no one's going to be saying anything about these other gods. They're all really the same, or the idols. It's just one God, because they're going to see him there. All the land from Geba, that's the north boundary of Judah, to Rimmon, south boundary of Judah, will be changed into a plain. No more mountains. That'll make the water flow easier. Now, I don't know why all this stuff will happen, but he's also going to elevate Jerusalem. It's not the only place in the prophets that says this. Jerusalem will be higher up, and the rivers will flow from the elevated Jerusalem east and west. Jerusalem will be raised up. It will remain on its site from the Benjamin Gate to the place of the first gate, to the corner gate, and the Tower of Hananel. These are just locales around the old city. People will live there. Said that in chapter 2. We read a vision where he said, I'm not going to have boundaries because there's so many people, they won't fit the old boundaries of the city, but the city is going to be flourishing with life, with people, and they're going to live there, and they're going to dwell in security. It's never happened. Watch the news. They've never really had security. The only way the Jewish people get security is if they die. The world has been at war with these people as long back as you remember. And you go and you look at the news now and it's still happening. So when does security, real security, happen? Not security where people, you know, lob missiles over on you. It happens here. It happens here in this time. There's going to be a plague. This is the sword out of the mouth of Jesus. And I'll try to wrap this up pretty quick. But there's a plague. I've always wondered, well, how does the sword out of the mouth of Jesus deal with the enemies? Well, here it is. This will be the plague which the Lord strikes all the people who have warred against Jerusalem. Remember in verse 1, how they felt pretty good about themselves? They were getting their medals of valor. They were taking the stuff out of people's homes. They were raping people, all these terrible things. This is the payback. And they're not going to like it. Because the plague which the Lord strikes on all the people that warred against Jerusalem, their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet. I talked to somebody about this last week, and they reminded me of that one of the Indiana Jones movies where they open. But also when they open the Ark of the Covenant in one of the movies, like the first one's the Holy Grail or whatever, which doesn't exist, and the other one's the Ark of the Covenant, and it sort of eats the flesh off. It was scary when I was young. This is scarier. Their flesh will rot while they stand. Their eyes will rot in their sockets. Their tongues will rot in their mouths. In other words, the flesh is going to be gone before the bones kind of pile up on the ground. This isn't very pretty at all. And a great panic will happen, you would think. A panic from the Lord will be among them. They'll start fighting among themselves. We call that friendly fire. Hey, when did this happen? Go back into the Old Testament, that war with Gideon, where God pulled the army down to it was just really, really little for Gideon, and they had a big army on the other side, and they all started fighting each other because they're all confused and dazed. It's this thing here. But now it's happening with a really big international force. Judah will fight. He said this earlier in the book, that he would make the weak man, the weak person, in Judah as strong as David, and the strong person like God. That was the metaphor just earlier in the book. This is happening. When Jesus returns, those people who are just supposed to be victims, they're fighting too. They're going to fight. Judah will fight at Jerusalem. The wealth of the nations is collected, the gold and the silver and all that. That's what happened in the book of Exodus when Israel finally left Egypt. They took all the money with them. They came here to plunder Israel, but they're going to make a big deposit before they leave. And that's what's happening here. It's the total underdog story being reversed in every way. Verse 16, all the survivors from the nations that came against Jerusalem, that's the Gentiles. Not all the Gentiles are dying. But those who come to fight Jerusalem are going to die, every last one of them. There won't be one that just barely gets away. In Zechariah 9, I tried to show there in the first half of the chapter that it pictures a future time when God deals with Israel's enemies, but there's also a remnant of Gentiles who are the people of God too. That's what's happening here. They're coming to Jerusalem. Those nations that had come to do battle are now coming to worship. They're coming year after year to worship the king, Jesus, the king of Zechariah 9:9, or the triumphal entry. They're going to worship in there, not because there's a church building, a really big one there. It's because he's there. They're going to physically see him. He's the king, the Lord of armies. So here he's putting in apposition, in equality, Jesus the King with the Lord of Hosts. This is an Old Testament a proof of the deity of Christ right here. It's one of the really good ones. And they're going to celebrate the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles. You had Yom Kippur, and then after that you had the Feast of Booths. Yom Kippur, I argue, was fulfilled in Zechariah 12 and 13. That's the Day of Atonement. It's the day when you deal with sin. But the Feast of Tabernacles is a day of celebration, and it comes on the Jewish calendar later, and it looks back to God and his people dwelling together in the wilderness in the book of Exodus, and they had that communion. They looked like poor people out in the desert where meat and water just appeared like magic because God was doing these things, and they could see the presence of God manifested in the fire by night and the smoke by day. And so this celebrates it. But it was always going to have a complete fulfillment in the kingdom when God, the Son, is physically present with his people. That's what's happening here. And Tabernacles was always intended to incorporate non-Jewish people and incorporate Gentiles. So this is a fulfillment. This is why in the New Testament, Peter sees In James and John, the transfiguration, the Mount of Transfiguration, they kind of see Jesus glorified, and their first reaction, let's make some tabernacles, because he's here in all his glory.
Do you think this is happening at the same time as the war in heaven when Michael slew the dragon?
I think it's happening right at the end. So I think that Michael's dealt with it, and we're at the tail end, and really we're past the 7 years. This is essentially the wedding feast of the Lamb, to put it in New Testament terms. This is the beginning of the kingdom. I think the Feast of Tabernacles, in a sense, is the entirety of the kingdom, because you're always with God. But they set aside this time to come and celebrate it during that what we're told in Revelation is 1,000 years. So, he goes on to say in the last couple of verses, everything is holy. In Jesus' kingdom, everything is holy. He says the words holy to the Lord, which traditionally were put on the hat, the turban of the high priest. He wore an engraving that said holiness to the Lord. You had common things and you had holy things. In his kingdom, you have no common things. You only have holy things. And so holiness to the Lord isn't only on the hat of the high priest, it's on the bells of the horses. Animals Jewish people don't own, but those things are now holy. The pots in the house of the Lord, the ones that aren't fancy, you know, the plastic spoons and forks you pull out for family when they come, it's holy to the Lord. Everything's holy to the Lord. Every pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be holy to the Lord. So on that day there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord. It's not that there won't be people from that part of the world. A Canaanite's an idiom for an evildoer, a sinner, a pagan, and there will be none at that day. Well, we end there. Let me pray, but if this raises, you have some questions or something, I'm happy to chat, but we need to close it out.